Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to our viewing audience across the pond. I am Jason Miles, your host, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, please hit subscribe, and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you are alerted whenever we go live, as we are constantly adding new shows and doing cross streams with other channels constantly. Also, just two more days, today and tomorrow, and MT said she's down to do a special fundraising stream, maybe tomorrow morning, for Kayfabe, a feature-length documentary about the way we consume media. Discuss the rise of cable news, or as most people call it, mainstream media, and we juxtapose it to pro wrestling. Very, very funny, informative, and entertaining documentary. We're almost finished with it. We need your help. Wherever you are watching or listening to this show, there should be links in the description to the fundraising site, Indiegogo. There should be a QR code over my head that you can just scan. It takes you right to fundraiser. Also, before I bring in the gang, I just want to thank all of the subscribers on YouTube and Twitch and all the other audio formats. Without you, we couldn't do this. And if you would like to have access to Champagne Rooms, past and present, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert Mau Mau Hour, join us for our movie nights. There's only one way. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. Now that we quickly got that out of the way, let me bring in someone that really doesn't need an introduction. My co-host, King of Miami, Florida. The man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
Are you excited about the show today?
I very much like the subject matter of the show today because I like food.
I do have to give a big fat shout out to Jeremy Salmon. If you guys didn't know, Jeremy is definitely a member of the TIR crew. He puts together movie night for us. He was a huge technical help for the live show in Los Angeles. And he connected Arun and I probably two plus years ago when Jeremy was still doing a podcast. And he's constantly telling me, Jason, you got to get this guy on. He sent me the Descent piece, and I reached out and some back and forth between Arun and I, and we finally got it scheduled. So I'm excited about this. You know what else I'm excited about? Some may call her a disembodied voice. We here at TIR call her a diversity hire. She is the M. Toussaint.
Diversity hire. That's no way to treat TIR Barbie.
Wow.
Well, the other TIR Barbie.
Who's the original one? Stefan?
That would be you.
That'd be me.
The original Funshine TIR Barbie.
We have a serious topic here, and you're over here cracking jokes. I knew you guys were going to be excited about this show because our guest was talking about food in New York. Mm. And I'm sure at some point in this show, pizza will come up in the discussion. Yeah. And our guest will probably have some very, very smart guy explanation on why New York pizza is definitively better than any other pizza. And this will be your justification shot, Pascal and Toussaint, for why your pizza is the best. So I'll be waiting for you guys to ask that question if it's not the first. One thing we take for granted, or maybe we're blinded by capitalist realism, is ethnic food and how it can differ in taste and quality depending on not just who's making it, but who they're making it for. Our guest today has a monthly column in Descent magazine where he explains to his readers that food is a social product of capitalism. Apocalypse Chow will explore how physical tastes are socially produced. For the first column, Arun explains why the best tasting Chinese dumplings tend to be the cheapest. And this is all a quote from the intro piece. Future columns will tackle the rise of platform foods like pizza, burgers, and sandwiches, the spread of fake bistros in Paris, America's crucial role in popularizing Japanese ramen, the production problem that led Starbucks to invent the Frappuccino. I'm very intrigued on that. Why culinary authenticity is real. And I'll recommend some great restaurants along the way. And the eye is a ruin, of course. As a graduate of the French Culinary Institute, former chef and restaurant reviewer, currently working as an investigative reporter, as well as a guide for historical food tours around New York City, Arun takes a sensual approach to food, one that understands it is a source of tremendous joy and belonging, fraught with fears and anxieties, and a site for heated political battle. How we understand food and cuisine can teach us a lot about how capitalism shapes our daily lives. Food can show us how to build a future rich in social, cultural, and culinary variety, where we don't just rethink labor and work, family, and gender, but experience them in endlessly delicious ways. Please welcome, he will also be a disembodied voice on this show, coming all the way live from a bistro in Paris, where I'm sure there's a cigarette hanging out of his mouth as he's talking to us right now. Arun Gupta.
A cigarette and un verre de vin.
Or I should have said with the holder.
Yes, yes. thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. Would I be cheating if I asked you to explain the Starbucks Frappuccino creation? Because that was too juicy of a thing to start off with.
No, not at all. So this is something that's in my book, Apocalypse Chow. That's where the Descent magazine column comes from. And I'm hoping it'll be out in a couple of years or so. It's been an interesting adventure. So what I try and do is use the tools of Marxist political economy to understand taste itself. Now, we see these tools incredibly important and really can help us understand the role of labor, production, distribution, consumption, where do you shop? How do you shop? Taking the car to a supermarket, buying all these box goods, or even not doing that anymore, Amazon deliveries or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Marxism is almost never, at least in the popular press, applied to taste, because and I make a very strong distinction between the academy and intellectuals and the popular press, and they talk about food in very different ways. And I think one of the big problems with how most people, what you'll see unless you're immersed in food studies, is scientific reductionism, the idea that tastes are a product of neurobiology, chemistry, physiology. And sure, obviously there is a physiological component to taste. It matters a lot. But it does not explain why we eat the things that we eat, or even why we like the things that we like. And something, I think the Frappuccino is a good way to kind of ease it to it both to understand some of the tools of political economy, as well as how taste is constructed. I've only ever had a Frappuccino once, and I thought, I'm not going to say it's terrible, right? It's basically an adult milkshake. That's all it is. It's a caffeinated milkshake. And I actually did it for a friend helped me. We did a short film where we were talking about the Doritos Locos Tacos and Frappuccino, because they're both very similar marketing campaigns. But we're looking at it also from the perspective of taste. So I'm not sure when. I think Frappuccinos have been around, 20 odd years, early 2000s. So in Capital, Marx, I think volume 2, maybe volume 3, he talks about the production time problem. let's say you're a factory owner in the early 1800s in England, and you have a jam factory. And so during the summer, you're following the seasons or the harvest, right? So you have the strawberries that come in, and then maybe the raspberry, peaches, I don't know if they grew blackberries in England at that time, you know, and then you'll have in the fall things like the hard stone fruits, you know, like pears and apples. But when it came winter time, there was nothing. So the capitalist, what he does is, because of course it was always he in those days, he can shut down the factory, he can turn off the basic utilities that existed, no more cold deliveries, you know, shut the water off, and then you just have a guard who watches the plant while it's mothballed. But that plant still is a huge capital investment. And you as a factory owner want to be producing 24/7. Now, this story is I actually get from David Harvey, because I took all three classes on capital with him. And he said what happened is some capitalist figured out that there were these huge crops of oranges that were coming into season over the winter in Spain, in Seville region in particular. And so he started importing them. That means that you can now operate the factories basically the whole year long. And it also explains why marmalade became so popular. It's considered, you know, kind of quintessential part of the British breakfast. And my parents grew up in colonial India, and I was actually born in England, and there was always marmalade on the breakfast table, even though I didn't like it. I like strawberry jam, but that's also because it's childish taste, right? Children don't like bitter stuff. So in any case, we can apply the same. Starbucks had the same exact dilemma. So, you know, Starbucks, I guess, is what it's like the first wave of the coffee revolution. They're
the first coffee bar in the States, I think. Well, like that model, right?
Well, the reason I say that, we're on like the third or fourth or maybe even fifth wave of the coffee. You know, it's just like, you know, it's all, I don't even keep track of them. It's just like, who knows what wave we're on at this point. But Starbucks is the one who made the idea of like, hey, that coffee should cost as much as like, you know, a beer or a cocktail in a bar. And you should consider it like this kind of little luxury treat for yourself. And so, you know, they have, what is it, like 11,000 stores. They're actually classified as a fast food joint. Around the United States. And then, of course, they're also engaged in a vicious union busting campaign, so you should not go into a Starbucks. So in any case, so they had this problem in that they would get this morning rush and it would kind of last through lunch, but after 2 p.m., boom, the stores were dead. And it doesn't cost much to the store opened, right? What do you have? You have light, you have a little electricity, a little, you know, gas or whatever to keep the water hot. And then you have some, like, you know, minimum wage worker who's getting paid shittily. But so you could keep it open, but they weren't getting any traffic. So they end up buying this other company. You know, this is how corporations become big. It's not because they're such great inventors. It's that they leverage their capital to buy other companies that have invented stuff. So in this case, they buy a company that basically has a Frappuccino-like drink. And what they do is they realize that they can take this and basically create a new eating opportunity. And they they create the Frappuccino Happy Hour. And what they do is they convince millions, tens of millions of Americans that, hey, when it's late in the day and you're feeling sluggish, you know, it's like 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock and you need a pick-me-up and, you know, your dinner's hours away or you're going to be stuck at the office, come into Starbucks for the Frappuccino Happy Hour. And so now, if especially if you live in a business district, boom, you know, you can go in there around 4 o'clock, and there'll be lines of people getting frappuccinos and other similar drinks. But unlike, you know, a coffee, which, you know, black coffee obviously has zero calories in it, espresso, zero calories, and all that, a regular frappuccino's got, I think, something like 500 or 600 calories, and they go up there. Like, I think you can, you know, when you start to do all the add-ons, they could be 1100 calories or more. But essentially what Starbucks did was they convinced millions of Americans that, hey, you can have a coffee, even though it's really a milkshake, as a pick-me-up later in the day. And they turned it into a billion-dollar product. And those are often known as category killers. You know, a food product that's making over $1 billion by itself. But what they're doing is externalizing costs onto the rest of society, right? If you are having all this sugar and fat, you know, between lunch, between dinner, you know, people are going to be gaining weight. They're going to be having the risk for obesity-related diseases, like cardiovascular disease, like diabetes, stroke, different types of cancer rise that then society has to pay for. And so, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon of how they dealt with what was essentially this production time problem. You know, so I'll let you jump in if you want at this point.
No. Keep going. This is great.
So, you know, this now what's also interesting about it is who was it? Was it Taco Bell that had its the fourth meal campaign?
That was Taco Bell, fourth meal. Yeah.
And so, if you've ever now y'all may experience this, like you do fundraising for your show, right? Mm-hmm. So I've published a number of newspapers. I did The Independent, The Occupied Wall Street Journal, some others. And there's a rule in fundraising. The person most likely is to give you money is a person who has already given you money. And this is this hard and fast rule of the fast food and processed food industry. You know, you'll see these statistics about like, oh, 80% of Americans visit McDonald's every month. And don't quote me on these numbers. But McDonald's, though, they actually segment their customers into different groups. And there's heavy users who come into McDonald's, I think, at least once a week, once or twice a week. And then there's super heavy users. They're coming into McDonald's more than 3 times a week, you know, often every day. And the thing about like the super heavy users accounts for, I think, like less than 10% of their customer base, but they produce over 60% of their revenues. And so I actually found, you know, something from a long, like decades ago, where McDonald's was doing the same thing, that they were trying to invent a new meal. And, you know, and so what we literally have is companies who are basically trying to get people to shove more food in their pie hole, more highly processed, you know, fatty, sugary, salty foods. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of processed foods that I love. Like I love Doritos, I love Oreos. I'm not a fan of them. They're almost all terrible. I do like Popeye's fried chicken. That's about it.
You are a good man. That's why.
But I think McDonald's hamburgers are terrible. They don't taste like shit except the condiments.
It's interesting that you say that because I moved to Mexico in the last 2 years, and there is one McDonald's kind of around me within a 50-mile radius. And to get there, I'd have to pass literally 200 amazing Mexican restaurants and taco stands to get to one McDonald's, and I never go to McDonald's.
Yeah, right. Why would you? I mean, my God, you know, it's like the food, and you know, that food is also like fatty, and but it's probably going to be healthier for you, and it's probably you probably will get some vegetables. You're getting, mm-hmm. you know, if you find some place that you know is make you know they're getting their tortillas from a good tortilleria. You're going to get some carbs in it. You can load up on all those delicious salsas. Hey, salsas are vegetables, you know. Yeah, I mean, there's so much better food to have than crappy fast food. And often fast food is not the cheapest stuff out there also.
No, not at all. Pascal, I know you have some questions.
Yeah, I definitely do. Aaron, I really appreciate your article, as I was telling you when we were in the green room. One of the things you explained so eloquently in your piece is how political economy shapes much of the cuisine we have in America, and especially related to immigrants. Can you elaborate on that for our audience, on how the correlation between the political economy of immigration often affects how we get certain types of foods that we have access to within our cuisine palate?
Yeah, so the thing about there's been a revolution in cuisine in the last 50 odd years, and my family came to the U.S. in the early 1970s. I'm actually an immigrant myself. I was about 5 years old when we came over, and there's something like apparently like 3 million Indian Americans who were born abroad. When we came over, there was something like less than 50,000 Indian Americans who lived in the entire U.S. And so what immigrant communities do is they will often bring their food culture over with them, because food is an incredibly important connection to the homeland. It's like at this point I describe cuisine, you know, not diet, not food, but cuisine as a symbolic language that we eat. Because it just embeds so much about culture, about gender, about spiritual beliefs, about work, family. There's so much to it. And it's also a practice you do multiple times a day. So it becomes very important to identity formation. And, you know, even though I'm an immigrant, I was essentially enculturated in the U.S. And what I say is, if it wasn't, the way I know I'm Indian is because of Indian food, and in particularly the way I know I'm Punjabi is because of Punjabi food. So what immigrants are trying to do, especially as technology has and supply chains, management, retailing, all that has become so sophisticated, they're trying to recreate food ways in their adopted country. And so they're, you know, trying to source the authentic ingredients. And I totally argue that culinary authenticity is absolutely real. They're trying to source authentic ingredients, or if they can't, you'll have farmers who'll start to grow them within the United States. You'll see, like, what happened. I grew up outside of Baltimore, and I saw this development happening in the 70s and 80s. Like, the first stores were literally Indian families had stores in their living rooms, like grocery stores, right? And in fact, my folks, for years, we had a sari store, a clothing store in our basement. And if you're successful, the ones who made enough money and were committed to it would then open grocery stores. And the first grocery store that my folks went to was actually an apartment in downtown Baltimore, right? You go into this building, you go up to the second floor, and it's just an apartment, but they had turned it into a little grocery store. And as the culture starts to develop, then you get the restaurants, then you start to get kind of more elaborate supply chains, and it builds and it builds and it builds. But one of the most important aspects, so, you know, when people think about cuisine, they always think about cooks. And unfortunately, you know, there's a whole gender nature to cuisine, which is really problematic, that we celebrate all the chefs, which is a heavily male-dominated industry, especially when you move up the hierarchy. But I argue it's just like we need to look at the restaurant industry as its own distinct type of food. And often the best food that you can get is in the home. And the reality is in the United States, where I, you know, the last time I looked at the stats, I think women do something like 79% of domestic labor. It's a lot better than it was in the 70s, you know, when it was like 94%, but we still have a long way to go to have parity. So they're the ones who are doing the cooking, right? And so women, certainly still today, but historically have been, they're the ones who transmit culture from one generation to the next. And it's often happening through cuisine. And so it's within these immigrant communities where you get these types of intense food production. And then, you know, there's this whole Marxist thing about, I'm trying to remember, it's like, I forget what the terms are, but there's a distinction between paid and unpaid labor. And obviously, domestic labor is unpaid. And there's a whole argument about how the unpaid domestic labor is essential for the reproduction of the working class. And this is something that the factory owners relied upon, that they could pay their workers lower wages because the women were able to take the raw agricultural goods and turn them into food at a cheaper cost than you know, the workers could buy the food already prepared. And so women serve this incredibly important role. And, you know, I obviously, as someone who has cooked professionally, I think it's crucial that we democratize this type of nurturing culinary role within the home, and that men have on very much right, someone said socially necessary labor in the comments, and that men should, you know, be taking on this type of social necessary labor. But because immigrants also tend to come with significant support networks, and there's also obviously exploitation of immigrants, both within their community, outside of the community. What I'm looking at, particularly the dumplings piece that people, they can read it on either Dissent or my Substack. If you can throw the link to my Substack up there in the comments. Is that immigrant labor tends to be super exploited. You know, people are working for minimum wage, below minimum wage. There's a lot of wage theft. And in particular, what happened in the Chinese restaurant industry in New York City over the last 30 years is that there is a huge, I've been a huge influx in New York City of undocumented immigrants from Fujian. And so the men in particular flooded into the restaurant industry. And so this created a situation where restaurant owners could pick and choose. I liken it to a form of natural selection, right? You could pick the workers who were, you could exploit the most, who were the fastest cooks, who were the best at things. And so, but this also made the Chinese restaurant industry in New York City hyper-competitive. And so on the food tours that I go on, I take people to this one particular dumpling spot in Manhattan Chinatown. And New York is so massive, there's 9 different Chinatowns in the city. But the historic one is that everyone knows is the one downtown. And this place is bare bones, it's dingy, it just looks like a cafeteria. And I took a group of kind of like lefty authors and journalists there on one of my food tours, and one of them remarked about, like, I would never go in a place like this, but the dumplings were excellent. You know, why is that? And so that's what the genesis of the food that the political economy of Chinese dumplings, because I've been in this particular dumpling spot like 100 times. I live in downtown, right on the edge of Chinatown. And there's tons of these dumpling spots. What they are, they're essentially canteens for the working class. Like, you know, what I explain to people when you walk around the immigrant neighborhoods in New York City, there's a way to easily identify a lot of a real working class immigrant neighborhood. Like Chinatown is a living, breathing working class immigrant neighborhood. It's basically swallowed up most of Little Italy. Little Italy is a tourist trap. It's a Disney-fied version, which is why the food tends to be so bad there. But in all these like dumpling houses, if you walk around working class immigrant neighborhoods, what you often notice is lots of bakeries. So in Mexican neighborhoods, it'll be panaderias, right? In Paris, you'll see lots of doner kebab stands, or Nigerian and Tunisian bakeries, because these are foods that are tasty, they're cheap, they fill you up, they're fast to make, they're fast to eat, portable. And, you know, if you notice my introduction, I had this whole thing, I mentioned this about platform foods, right? And so what capitalism has done is create all these platform foods. So dumplings, pizzas, tacos, burgers, and they all tend to be very similar. It's basically a starch and a filling, usually a meat, but they can be, you can make them in endless varieties, and they're portable, they're fast, they're cheap, they're easy to eat. And so when you get these dense working class immigrant neighborhoods, you do get a lot of single men in particular, and they go to these joints for a quick meal. Now, the place I take folks, it's like 10 dumplings for $4.50, right? They're 45 cents each, but they're so good. And, you know, it's just like they're really, they're thin, their skins are nice and thin, they're cooked properly, they're never torn, never open. The fillings are aromatic. They're juicy. They've got this nice flavor, and they're excellent. And this is on Grand Street. I named the location in the descent column. People can find it there. And if people can also email me if they want to join a food tour, my email's there as well. And so this place is below Houston, right? It's south of Houston. So if you cross Houston Street, everything gets more expensive. It's much more hipster. It's the East Village. It's the West Village. And you can, there are plenty of dumpling spots, but there it's like six dumplings are going to be like $12, $14 plus tax and tip. And they don't taste as good. The cooks aren't as skilled because they're not making thousands of dumplings a day. Like this place on Grant Street, this Chinese dumpling place, I estimate, and I think it may be a low ball, that they might make a million dumplings a year. Because I've stood there and watched them pull out, like hundreds of dumplings, like 300 dumplings at a time, a dumb waiter, as well as a 5-gallon bucket full of dumpling mix, which is enough to make 1,200 more dumplings. And there's all these workers at back just working furiously. And I call it the Walmart model. You know, so because the Chinese restaurant industry became so competitive, you then have to compete on volume. And when you have these workers who are making so many dumplings day after day, and if you've ever cooked professionally, you know, mm-hmm. Just like it's that daily practice, that rigor, that's what makes you a good cook, that those are going to be really damn fine dumplings. Now, there are plenty of crappy dumpling spots in Chinatown as well. Their virtue is that they're cheap. There's also plenty of mediocre ones, but I take folks around to the best ones for obvious reasons. So, but it's these particular conditions of the labor, of the immigrant community, the density that creates a cuisine that is going to be better than a lot of the hipster, much better than nearly all the hipster artisanal versions out there.
I want to ask you a question based on what you just said, which is very important. Do you think that capitalist realism is the only methodology that allows us for us to have quality cuisine? In other words, if we had a true socialist economic model, which destroys the economic exploitation of labor that is necessary to have such cuisine, is it possible to still have the quality of food that we have? In other words, is capitalism necessary to maintain the exploitation of labor needed to keep fine dining or even working class dining going in the world or the United States?
No, not at all. First of all, let's remember that the restaurant industry is very new. It only goes back really to late 18th century England, France. And even then, it's only post-World War II where it starts to become common for families to eat out. And, you know, we can get, I don't want to get into arguments about capitalist subsumption, right, that everything is ultimately within the capitalist system. But I know for myself and for my mom as well, who's a fantastic cook, she makes amazing Punjabi cuisine, and she's so good she had her own catering business for a while, that we're doing it out of love. You know, we're doing something. We want to make this food and give it to people who are close to us because it's an act of love. It's an act of nurturing. It's an act of care. And the food in the home is often, because it isn't necessarily subjected to the imperative, and it's often not subjected to the imperative of profit, you can make more elaborate and better food than you can find in any restaurant. Now, I think restaurants can do certain things extremely well and some things extraordinary well that you can't find in the home. But that's why I make a distinction between restaurant, the let's say restaurant cuisine and home cuisine, that there is some overlap, but they are also two very different things, you know. And the thing is, you know, and I tell people, it's just like, you may think you've had Indian food, and specifically I'm talking about North Indian food, Punjabi food. You may think you like it, but unless you've ever eaten in a Punjabi home or been to the Punjab, you've never had real Punjabi food. It is very different from what you see in the restaurants. And I think it's also much better that you can get nearly anywhere in the U.S. And I think the thing about socialism, I think it has much more potential for variety, for different types of production systems, that we can have much more delicious food under socialism than we have under capitalism. Capitalist food is mostly garbage.
That's a fair response.
I was actually going to see, I know MT had something she wanted to add.
I wanted to ask, if I go to a pizza place in New York City and I don't see any Italians, should I eat at that pizza place?
Ooh.
Well, I mean, you know, the question is like, you know, are you talking Italian or Italians, right?
Wow.
I'll take a little Jersey
answer. I actually understand what that means.
I did not see that one coming. Can you explain the difference between the I and E?
Hey, what are you talking about, huh? what are you busting my chops for, Jason? I mean, forget about it. Get out of here.
An Italian.
Actually, one of the highest compliments I got a few months ago, I was checking out a new Italian sandwich shop on the Lower East Side, and the guy was, and you know, we're talking about Italian sandwiches, and he just turns to me, and he's just like, "You from Bensonhurst?" You know, he thought I was Italian. You know,
you're one of those dark ones from the south.
Exactly. Sicilian paisan.
So,
why don't we talk about the pizza belt theory? This is not mine. It's I'm blanking on his name. He's one of the guys who started Serious Eats. And if you Google Ed something, he's written a book on pizza before. But he has this theory, and I think it's correct, that the best pizza in the United States is to be found in a belt that goes from northern New Jersey through New York City, and it ends in New Haven, Connecticut, where there's like two or three fantastic pizza places. And I argue the belt buckle is Brooklyn. And the interesting thing about New York City is that, Queens is incredible for its international cuisine. Queens is, I think, probably about the population of Houston, like 2.3 million, and it's majority immigrant. But there's no good pizza to be had in Queens. Meanwhile, right next to it is Brooklyn, which has all this incredible pizza. But this is a historical legacy. Because the thing about you can't have, there's this mistake with cuisine that it comes from chefs, it comes from professionals, it comes from cooks, but you can't have real cuisine without eaters. It's the eaters who kind of regulate boundaries of what is and isn't belong in that cuisine. That's why for the longest time you could not find, and it's still hard to find, thankfully, blueberry bagels in New York City. Because New Yorkers are like, what the hell is this? Blueberry bagels, that's garbage. Or, what is it? The Asiago and sun-dried tomato bagels. What is this crap? Give me a sesame bagel, a poppy bagel, an onion bagel, right? Maybe an everything bagel, all these like ridiculous inventions just don't fly in New York City. But, in terms of pizza, it's just like, I think New Yorkers in general know good pizza, and the reason pizza is such a quintessential New York food. Let's see who can answer this. Is because New Yorkers turned it into a sandwich. And do you know how did they fold the pizza? Exactly, the fold, right? And so what that does, it's portability. And this is very important in terms of social reproduction. Once you do the fold, it's basically a sandwich. It's two pieces of bread with a filling inside. You can now walk down the street and eat. You can grab a slice and be on your way to your appointment, to your job, to the subway. It has that portability and transportability that enables your rapid social reproduction, and that is why I think pizza is so just indelibly part of New York culture.
I'm just glad that you excluded that monstrosity that comes out of Chicago.
I was going to ask you about that before you.
That's a casserole. The deep dish is not pizza. It's a casserole.
Thank you. I feel good.
Is there no real Italians in Chicago? Is that what you're saying? You're going to shit on the plane?
Well, I think there's plenty of Italians in Chicago. And hey, I love Italian food. I love red sauce joints. I love Italian sandwiches.
Red sauce joints. Oh,
this is a gang war that I want to see is Chicago Midwestern Italians versus New York Italians. They all dress like Danny Aiello and do the right thing.
But, in terms of like cultures bringing their cuisines over, there are cultures who didn't. I have this good book on Italian, Jewish, and Irish foodways, and it's done by a scholar. And when she gets to the Irish, she's basically like, yeah, Irish food is terrible. They just bought over their whiskey and music.
Well, Anglo-American cuisine isn't Anglo food or food from the British kind of area, their food is not that good. It's not known for producing good cuisine at all, quite frankly, as far as I know.
Oh, no, it's terrible. I mean, they one of the high points of their cuisine is a chip buddy. It's a French fry sandwich.
Oh, that sounds God. Like something a child would make.
Actually, some of my favorite food is Middle Eastern food. I think that's really underappreciated in terms of the quality of the cuisine. It's very, very tasty. It's very, very good.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is, so I had the opportunity because I had friends who were like, in different countries who are telling me to come stay with me. So I was able to spend a good bit of time going around Europe on the cheap. And so I went to like Istanbul, I went to Athens, I went to Madrid, but I've been to like Northern European countries. And there is something about like, there's this like climate line, like those countries on the Northern Mediterranean, almost all of them have really good cuisines, except the very poor ones. But once you start to go to the north, the cuisine just becomes terrible. Like Norway, some of the worst goddamn food in the world. And they're also one of the richest countries, which is, but it's. I mean, if you're into caribou and fish, hey, they've got some good stuff for you.
Oh. Arun was looking for a McDonald's in Norway. He's like, ah, God, is there like a Burger King around here or something? Anything? Goddamn gefilte fish.
I had some good fish in Oslo, you know.
I
wanted to ask you another question also, Arun, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
How have online food delivery apps such as Uber Eats affected the political economy of cuisine and food production?
Well, you know, so I tell in the book when I'm talking about American cuisine, I love bacon. And in fact, the title of my book for a long time was Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. But now you can like basically, you don't have to do anything. We've even moved beyond push button. You can be like, hey, Alexa, I want, you know, a BLT and fries from such and such joint and have it delivered to me. And it'll order it, it'll pay for it. All you need to do is open the door and it'll be there, you know, in 30 minutes or an hour or so. Whereas when we think about like what it was just like a few centuries ago, and when we think about, you know, human history, it's just like a few centuries is really not that long ago. So we're talking about colonial America, like around 1700, late 1600s. Now, if you wanted bacon then, what you had to do, pigs were very common in the colonial America. They were very well suited to the forested environments. They could forage on their own. They could protect themselves. You just fed them scraps. There wasn't the land to raise cattle or sheep, you know, and in fact, through the 19th century, there was this phrase called the tyranny of the pig, because Americans ate so much pork because it was so easy to raise. But if you wanted to have bacon, here's what it usually involved. Woman, and it was usually the woman, would straddle the pig. She would clasp it tightly between her legs. She'd pull the snout up. She'd take a knife and slit the throat. And there's usually a bowl there to catch the blood because you're not wasting anything. Then she would butcher the pig. And of course, we're not talking big pigs here, right? You know, maybe they're 100, 150 pounds or so. You know, you have to like quickly cut up all the meat. You're saving virtually all the organs. And then you take the meat and you have to brine them in barrels. And there are particular cuts, obviously, that would be used for the bacon more than others. but usually you were brining any meat that you were going to save. And then you have to brine them a while. But that, of course, means you have to have the barrels, you have to have the salt, the water to make the brine. You had to build your own smokehouse. And then after they had brined, I don't know, maybe a week or so, you would hang them, or at least a few days, you would hang them up in the smokehouse. And for weeks, you would have to slowly smoke them. And finally, at this point, you had meat that was preserved that you could then eat. But even then, you're just not going to eat it like that. What you're going to do is you're going to cut off a piece. You're going to throw it in the corn pone. You're maybe going to throw it in with some beans. So it was incredibly involved and laborious process, you know. Whereas now, like I said, you can just talk. You could get that bacon delivered to your door. Of course, all this labor behind it has been mystified. And, you know, we have these army of delivery drivers who are making, you know, you have the cooks, you have the delivery drivers who are making all this happen. And, you know, of course, this is only really being used by maybe 10 to 20% the population on a regular basis. They're probably the ones who are accounting for the vast majority of deliveries. But, you know, I think what it means is you get certainly inferior cuisine. It's not as interesting. It's completely socially alienated at every level. And it's not going to be as enjoyable. One thing I've noticed is if you watch fast food commercials, so fast food is eating alone, right? Something like 20% of meals in America happen in the car alone, right? But if you, next time you see fast food commercials, notice they're always eating with other people. There's always this kind of shared experience, right? And I think that's one of the worst things that we don't think about. And again, that's a very Marxist idea, the social alienation. We were thinking much more about labor and production. And of course, those are types of social alienation. But you as a consumer, you're alienated from the product. And you're also alienated from the worker who made the product and the worker who delivered the product. And I just, you know, like, I never get delivery food. Even though I worked myself through college as a pizza delivery driver, I can't tell you the last time I got any food delivered. You know, I want to go sit down in a restaurant and eat it or bring it home and cook it.
No, that's a good point. We have a super chat question. Do you see that super chat, Tucson? You
wanna... Yep. Let me pull it up.
All right.
So this super chat question comes to us from Jay.
Thank you, Jay.
Here we are, JW. With upcoming shortages, do we need to rethink the current full menu restaurant models, normalize a locally networked public dining model, would also feature all the varieties and skills in different areas?
Well, I would caution against peak food. There's been peak everything, peak oil, peak water, because the problem, even if, for one, there's already shortages, right? You know, Raj Patel wrote that really important book 20 years ago called Stuffed and Starved. You know, that there's like millions of people who are overnourished billions and billions of people who are malnourished. You know, there's plenty of people who are starving around the world already. And so there are shortages already. But the idea that there's going to be some sort of pervasive food shortages, I think is completely, it's overblown and it misunderstands how capitalism works. Capitalism is nothing if not very creative at making sure wealthy people get all the things that they want. So there's going to be, there'll be fine dining as long as there's a human civilization. I would also caution against the idea of localism, regionalism, seasonality, and organic. For virtually all of human history up until the last century, localism was a curse. Seasonality was a curse. Organic food was a curse, right? Humans were constantly battling hunger, starvation, and often famine. And, you know, the idea of, I think, eating locally is, you know, I think it has some merit, but we still want to have trade. I'm actually writing something now for Dissent for my next column about this bananas under, would there be bananas under socialism, this debate. And I think there's this kind of reactionary impulse that trade is bad. You know, and first of all, there are different types of trades. There's trade in goods. And, you know, we do have to question what type of trade would exist that's sustainable and democratically produced. But there's also trade in ideas and there's trade in people. And I think in a world that is socialist, that is liberatory, that is democratic, we would have a lot more trade in people, that people would have the freedom and leisure time to go on long, slow journeys to other parts of the world, and that you know, to experience cuisines where they developed and where they're probably going to be the best, potentially. In the world. The reason I hedge on that is I've had Korean friends tell me, a couple of Korean friends say that the best Korean food is in Los Angeles, not South Korea. And as one explained to me, it's just like the quality is better, there's more variety, and it's cheaper. And you have a massive Korean-American community who knows what this food it should taste like, who knows how to cook it, who knows how to source it, who knows how to eat it. I need to be going soon, unfortunately. I'm really enjoying this conversation. But it's Paris and it's Saturday night, and I need to have some foie gras and fine food, other fine food, foie gras.
Oh, tell the truth, you're going to a rave. You're going to a rave, and you're
going to McDonald's for a Le Royale.
Le Royale. Le Royale with cheese.
Thank you very much for joining us and taking the time to talk to us while you're in Paris. Wherever you are watching or listening to the show, there's links in the description to his monthly column in Dissent. He is Arun Gupta. Thank you very much, Arun, and have a very good night in Paris.
Thank you, guys. Thank you all.
That was fun. That was fun talk. I wish we could have had him for a little bit longer.
Great conversation. I had so many other questions.
The one question I had for him that I really wish we could ask, because he does kind of shit on Portland on his piece, and I wanted to ask him what he had against Portland. I wanted to see if we had similar opinions about Portland.
He got against Portland.
Poor quality of food.
He all but said, "Hey, those people don't know how to season their chicken." That's what I took from it. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe that's what it is. Oh, you know, Arun says he's happy to come back, so let's have him back on. Mm-hmm. I mean, this might be something we might want to have him on if he has the time. You know,
yeah,
the jet set lifestyle that he has to come back, because each column he's going to be discussing, I think, could be its own show.
We need to discuss Haitian bakeries.
Ooh, I was waiting for you guys to ask.
Oh yeah, you know, he says nothing about Caribbean food, Haitian food, or any about the history of the Haitian or the Caribbean immigrant experience in the milieu of immigrant food in the United States, which is a big deal on the East Coast, definitely in Florida and in other places.
Mm-hmm. We also need to get into Haitian patties versus Jamaican patties.
I just want you guys to get into a Haitian versus Jamaican fight, because I need to hear the difference in the accents, because to me, all of you guys are go, Lord of mercy.
Oh, God.
And then we can have Arun just talk about his idea of Portland, because I told you what I say Portland is. Portland is like Atlanta for white people.
I should say that about Boston.
No, because I don't know. I don't think white people go to Boston like they go to Portland like black people were going to Atlanta in the 90s.
Well, I think this is definitely a more recent migration to Portland as, like, you know, the mecca, like, of the, you know, post-industrial.
Like, remember when Portland was, like, in the cover of Time magazine for having all the neo-Nazis, and then the next week it was Portlandia? Like, everybody forgets that.
Oregon has really interesting kind of reactionary history to it. I mean,
yeah. History.
History.
Like, yes, Portland. See, we don't even call, like, there's the Northwest. Most people refer to the Northwest by the names of the major cities. They don't refer to the Northwest by the states.
It's the PNW.
You don't think of Washington, you think of Seattle, because the rest of Washington isn't Seattle at all. And no one likes to add Montana in the Northwest. And no one likes to think about, like, Idaho as part of the Northwest as well. Which I find it, as someone that spent too much time in the Northwest touring, it's an interesting place, to say the least. I don't know if you guys have... Sean Moon says the Klan basically wrote the original Oregon Constitution. Yeah, I mean, again, I think people think that they're all gone now. I'm like, I don't know why you guys think that, because it wasn't that long ago where they were taking over the state house over government land. It was, what, 4 years ago, 5 years ago?
Steve says the rest of Washington is Alabama. The rest of New York is Alabama.
There's a person that watches the show that's in Spokane. And I remember my first time in Spokane, I was like, whoa. I thought all of Washington was Seattle. And Washington said, no. No, we're not. No, we're not.
There can only be one Seattle.
Like going to Virginia and you go to Southern Virginia and Northern Virginia, two different worlds.
Someone said there's so many white supremacists in the Pacific Northwest. I'm like, damn.
It can be bad. It can be uncomfortable in certain parts of it. It can be very uncomfortable, especially when, like, the families walk into a place and they have, like, the his or hers firearms and shit on their person. Like, if you are at a McDonald's in northern Montana or western Montana and you see a family walk in and the wife has her pink 9mm showing, it's like, oof. And Fox News is playing on the TV. It's like, use the bathroom, get your coffee, and get back on the road, because this is not where you should be stopping.
Get those guys some pizza instead.
They're
doing a lot better.
Well, one thing I knew would be a consequence of this show, it made me hungry as hell, boy.
That is true.
Yeah, talking about dumplings and all kind of Italian food and whatnot. I'm like, bro, all I had this morning was a bagel. I was like, dude.
I'm stuck in my house because there's a massive music festival going on where the population of the city literally doubles. And so I'm not leaving.
Do you have anything to cook?
We'll see. I think so. I'm looking in my kitchen right now. Like, the water was shut off last night. I think it's back on.
Radishes.
She doesn't understand that they give you radishes with your tacos here in Mexico. I think they do it in the States too. But you guys live in New York. You guys live in New York. You don't have real taco places.
No. Sometimes they give you real. They give you radishes with your food. Yeah, that's true.
It's an every time thing. You get radishes and you get limes.
Depends on where you go. Yeah, limes too.
Yeah,
does everyone drink some Mexican beer?
Like the ones here or the ones in the States? Modelo?
No, not Modelo. What's the one that they sell in America that everyone drinks, the Mexican beer?
Dos Equis?
Dos Equis?
Not Dos Equis, man.
It looks like there's a lot of Mexican beer. Tecate?
Damn, there's a lot more Mexican beer.
Drink the Mexican soda, Jarritos.
I'm not drinking any soda because I'm trying to be slim.
Look at you.
So for my birthday show, I could do the whole show topless.
Oh, Lord.
You're not looking forward to that, Toussaint, next week?
Sunshine Barbie strikes again.
Before we go, I have to ask Pascal and Toussaint this because they both live in New York. And as we know, Pascal was at the original New York hip-hop party in 1973. He was only four, but every black person that is of age will say that they were there.
You won't catch me saying that shit.
I was there. We were all there. It was all of us. How do you feel about the 50th anniversary of You People's Music?
I have a very mixed feeling about the 50th anniversary of hip hop. I think that it's a very effective moment of capitalist marketing and capitalist infiltration into a music genre that has been one of the best promoters of capitalism within communities of color in the last 50 years. And I look at hip hop in the period of the 50 plus year counter revolution, and I don't see it as a radically transformative music form. I think it has done more to maintain the primary status quo of capitalism. I think the advent of coke rap and when crime became an aesthetic, the crime became an aesthetic of the music in the late 80s, early 90s. It took it down a very, very bad road. And I think there's a lot of reason to not celebrate this art form in terms of what it produces socially within the body politic of communities of color. Not to be a bummer.
Paul Prescott said, geez, way to be a bummer, Pascal. What do you say, Toussaint? You were also at that... even though you weren't born yet because you're only 28.
I was. I cleared the dance floor twice. You know, I'm only 28.
Yeah, you invented breakdancing that night.
You said KRS-One out here doing freestyles for Eric Adam. Hip-hop is fried. Good point.
That's just what it is, man. It's not like it was that different beforehand.
It's also institutionalized. Mm. It's going to be jazz at Lincoln Center soon.
Word.
But do those same jazz artists, are they COVID deniers? That's the question.
No.
When I watch hip hop guys, like, ooh, like I won't even watch an interview with anyone anymore. And I guess, and I don't know why this started, and I'm terrified to listen to the song. But Melly Mel has beef with Eminem.
Oh my gosh! Oh, that's such. Oh, it's not worth.
Going I don't even want to hear it, dude. Not that I have anything against Melly Mel. I mean, he's way too buff and roided out to have beef with. But what is the deal? What's the deal with Melly Mel?
Melly Mel made the statement that the only reason why Eminem is favored as a rapper is because he's white.
Still, I mean, it's been 20 plus years.
It's been white for a long time.
But I mean, that first record comes out what, like 99?
Was it in the late 90s? I thought it was earlier than that.
I mean, he's been around since the mid 90s that I know of.
I never liked Eminem. I'm not gonna lie. I think he's a good MC. Lyrically, in terms of the ability to produce a lyric that rhymes with another lyric that is catchy, he is skilled. He is skilled. My argument, I tell people all the time, I would have never gone to a hip hop party in all of my years when I used to party where anyone danced to Eminem.
Well, that's a different thing, right? Because that goes back to the whole they don't make the music to dance anymore. As Jazzy Jeff said, it's music to take selfies to at the club.
But the thing is, though, you got to remember, my era when I grew up listening to hip-hop in the 80s and the 90s, one of the aspects, aesthetics of hip-hop was it was dance music.
Right.
Yeah, and rappers danced. Big Daddy Kane danced.
Great dancers, too.
Chubb Rock danced. That era was over, I would say, not over, maybe different. Because they danced in the shiny suit era of hip hop, right? Because that's samples of nothing but
Jiggy, dance music. Jiggy era.
I like the shiny suit era. You know, I don't want to. It really puts it where it needs to be. Let's not even put a nice little colloquialism on it like Jiggy. Let's just call it the shiny suit era because it's just so transparently. Look at all the things I have. It's just they're not even rapping words anymore. It's just like commercials for high-end brands that nobody can afford. But you know, that's there's also a demarcating line around that same time where there's the what people call boom bap hip hop, where you have like maybe the more Tribe Called Questy type artists, and then you have where Eminem is going to kind of fall under. And that's not really danceable music because it's so rhyme centric.
Right.
And it's not really made for dancing. And if you want to dance, then you had the shiny suit stuff if you wanted to dance too, because now we're making a decision that MCs, because of the hammer hate, can't dance. Only clowns dance. And that's really what happens. When Third Base and all those guys start picking on MC Hammer, it's that, oh, you guys are clowns. Because look at all the people that danced before when Hammer was still coming up in the late 80s. They stopped dancing. And that music just kind of goes away. It morphs into R&B.
Like well, when I was in law school in the 90s and still going to these parties, we were still dancing. So...
You also were listening to house music, too.
We were listening to house music, too, as well. But there was still danceable hip-hop being made. Listen, I'm not trying to...
Yeah, that's also the end of that era. So you think
right.
about...
I'm not like, trying to crap on Eminem, right? I mean, listen, the guy is a... In terms of the skill of being an MC, a lyricist, he's very skilled. I'm just saying that I'm not a fan because... The things that I like about hip hop, one of them is the beat, the ability to dance, and that, you know, I come from that kind of like, you know, Big Daddy Kane, those cats. I didn't get that from his music.
No, because it's not that. It's taking that to the next level. I do think it's a spawn of that music. I do think so. But he's taking it to kind of a different level that's really more Rakim. I'm centered in the lyrical ability and how I can take different rhyme patterns over different beats and flip this in a way that you guys have never heard it. Whereas the other guys were rocking parties when people didn't give a damn what you were saying because you were yes, yes, y'all. And it really wasn't that fresh and it was all battle stuff. You know, my name is Pascal. I took your gal. You know, it's like that's the kind of overly simplistic stuff you're going to get over a disco beat. Which, you know, we're talking about four on the floor disco stuff slowed down a little bit so you can talk over it. And it's to keep the crowd moving and dancing. And by the time you get guys like Rakim, that's like Thinking Man's hip hop. Stuff is a little slower. It's definitely more jazz based, introspective lyrics where you just have to like, what did he just say right there? Like, I got to rewind that and hear that again. Like, oh my God. And, you know, even KRS-One isn't really music to dance to.
You got some beats. You got some boom baps.
Yeah, but it's not really. You can't name a KRS-One song you're going to put on the dance floor. So everyone's going to just fucking rush the dance floor.
Oh,
The Bridge is Over?
Step into two.
Rapture.
Rapture, yeah.
I guess that's one.
I would say the bridge is over. The bridge is over got a tight beat.
But are you dancing to the bridge is over, though?
It's got a banging beat, man.
There's a lot of banging beats. I mean, Cool Like That is one of the best bass lines of all time, but are you dancing to Cool Like That?
You could if you wanted to.
Okay. Then when we go to New York, you are showing me how you dance to Cool Like That, and you better not do your breakdance routine.
Take out the cardboard.
Take out the cardboard, yeah. Like, it's an interesting time in rap where there's stuff to dance to and there's guys that don't really make danceable music. And right now,
nobody's dancing now.
Nobody's really dancing now. They have mosh pits at hip hop shows. The last big hip hop festival I was at, which was Rolling Loud in like 2018, when it was in Oakland, I saw every artist until like the last two headliners were all yelling to open this pit up like it was a heavy metal show. And I was seeing kids, because where our office was located was right next to the like infirmary area, and kids were just, because they didn't really know how to mod, they didn't know the politics of a mosh pit, they were just literally beating the hell out of each other. Just girls with bloody faces accidentally with elbows. Oh, it was a nightmare. Oh, it was messed up.
That's because the only way to be a rock star is to be a rap star right now.
I agree.
It's really passe for rock to act like a rock star.
I totally agree. I think I told you about that. I had, because, you know, again, we're backstage, so all the artists are back there. And my work attire isn't very different from my show attire. But, I had a Megadeth shirt on, and all these rappers were stopping me like, bro, where'd you get that? They were like, is that a real one? I'm like, as opposed to a fake one?
Did you make that yourself?
Did you make that yourself? Because that's, I don't know if it's still a thing, but it's some sort of like, I'm a real hard cat because I have on this like metal shirt. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess. That's weird. But yeah, I don't know how to feel. I watched the LL Cool J performance with Black Thought, and I thought that was awesome.
I
think I sent it to you. Yeah, did I send it to you? The Rock
Yeah, Bell. So those are tight. I know somebody went to that. I know a couple of people went to that concert actually.
I thought that blew me away.
Yeah, some of my favorite MCs were in that concert.
I found Chuck D posted this thing. Chuck D is the greatest promoter of Chuck D. Like, no one is a better promoter of Chuck D than Chuck D. And I don't say that as like a knock on him. I say that because I'm jealous. But Chuck D posted this. Bjork was hosting some video show in like the 90s. And she's introducing a video on Nations of Millions Will Hold Us Back. I can't remember the video. And she goes, I'm not even going to try to do a Bjork accent because I can't do Icelandic accents, even though I grew up with one. She says, this is the most important album in the last 20 years that everybody should listen to, is It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And she introduces the song. And I thought that was kind of interesting because we had someone call into the show. You weren't on the show, Pascal, but they were talking. And we were talking about kind of these ideas around hip hop being revolutionary. And the guy that called in, I think he even said he was around your age, but he said the amount of people, how excited they were when Fear of a Black Planet came out when he was young, listening
to
it. And he said how many of his friends that were so excited when that came out ended up working in the finance industry.
Bro, let me tell you the biggest irony about Public Enemy, right? First of all, I have kind of Public Enemy's from Long Island. I went to college in Long Island. I went to Hofstra University. They're from Roosevelt. They used to, when they were, now Chuck D went to Adelphi University. Adelphi is 5 minutes from Hofstra. When they were early on in their career in college, doing college radio, they used to come to Hofstra parties. This is before my time. So guys I know who pledged me knew Public Enemy, and they were very beloved of them. So, like, they used to do the Long Island College radio set. And what is interesting is that they did have this kind of like radical persona that's juxtaposed all of these different types of politics that range from late civil rights to black power and even into like, you know, Louis Farrakhan and all kinds of stuff. What's really interesting is that for that generation, which is like my generation and a little older, they were so divorced from the quote-unquote radical politics of the 60s that Chuck D and Public Enemy simply creating a hodgepodge of imagery of elements of black radical, what were perceived of black, as black militancy, oftentimes with politics that didn't coincide. As we know, the Nation of Islam did not coincide with the socialist politics of the Black Panther Party or Stokely Carmichael or these other individuals. But because in the face of the Reagan era, that it seemed militant just because it talked what seemed to be pro-Black, it was transformative for our generation. Now, I can see how for younger kids today, it looks kind of corny, but during the Reagan years, it was like Public Enemy was the last, like the only bastion of what it felt to be radical for Generation X Black folk.
I mean, does it get more radical? Even for the younger cats, does it get more radical? Like, let's be honest. Then, what is this the trifecta of that moment? Public Enemy, Spike Lee. You had to have Spike Lee and then a copy of Stolen Legacy.
Yeah, all of that stuff.
Like, if you had those three things, you were like a serious black cat. We had to take seriously. Toussaint, do you disagree? Because I know this is before your time since you're only 28.
I don't know. I mean, I had my cousins who were older than me who were, you know, very pro-black, very Afrocentric. They had all the books. They had all the books. They had the X-Clan coming through to hang out. They were pretty radical.
To the East, my brother, to the East. Come on.
For real.
You were like a serious, serious person if you had those things. Remember when Ice Cube teamed up with the Nation of Islam in the early 90s? And like he was like and he had Cam and all those records. He was like a serious, like Ice Cube was serious.
Well, it's part of the reason, Gen X folk have some really regressive ass politics for a variety of reasons, man. And it's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't saying. I think the only difference is now you might see people. Someone mentioned No Name in the chat. You might see people mention socialism in their rhymes, and that means like, oh, I'm open minded. But it's so, you know, conflated with ideas of black nationalism that they are just kind of ingrained on them from those early days of hip hop as well.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't. I feel like hip hop hasn't progressed, and anybody that there's so much preaching to a choir because we have different categories in hip-hop now. Before it was just rap. Like I think I said before on the show, Biz Markie used to show us pictures of early hip-hop tours where it would be, there's a picture of him, Eazy-E, and Fresh Prince, and that was just the tour, and it made sense. Now you'd never see that, maybe on a festival. But even if everybody was alive in that picture, you would never see all those people together for a touring show because the audiences would be so different. And when hip hop was new, it was just like, hey, this is just rap. Kind of the same thing for stuff like heavy metal or punk. It wasn't over genrefied.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a bit of a problem.
I find the way affection for hip-hop arrested the maturation, arrested the becoming mature of certain generations of men, very problematic. Like, I've seen cats stuck in the, you know, hip-hop is my shiznit mode way too long. Like you shouldn't be there at like in your 40s. Like you should kind of like expand. Like, I'm not saying you can't not like the music, but I just find it questionable. Like, you know, 60-year-old motherfuckers are still talking about like hip hop. I'm like, you still talking about hip hop, man?
Like hip hop is something revolutionary, or just like they like rap?
I mean, nothing wrong with liking it. I still like the music. I still love lots of the music. But what I'm saying is, like, I feel like hip hop turned a couple of generation of folks out.
Mm.
They just turned them out. They're like, it's just a music form.
You know, that watch that documentary about Air Jordans, and that line that everybody's favorite director Spike Lee has, where he says, "You don't have to be at the Black Lives Matter protest. You can just wear your Air Jordans." And that's how I feel about hip hop. For a lot of people, it's like, I may not be in the fight, but I just bought, you know, album X, and that
so means capitalist friendly, man.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So capitalist friendly. And on that note, everybody, let's buy some cross colors. We got hats now, motherfucker. We watched Fear of a Black Hat on movie night, Pascal, and that, to me, exemplifies that era and still where that era is stuck. Trying to justify the bullshit that it says, that it's like this deeper meaning. You know, why do you call yourselves niggas with hats? Back in the slave days, workers in the fields didn't have no hats. No beanies, no babushkas, nothing.
No babushkas.
And what we're trying to say is, we got hats now, motherfucker. So, as Sean Moon says, commodify your descent. Yes.
Ooh.
Yes. Show me angry music and I will show you descent commodified. And what do you get when you commodify descent? You know, you get pop punk. You get eating niggas ass.
Oh God.
God, man.
You just gave Pascal acid reflux.
Okay.
Eating what?
In the show, and I can't, because I can't. I keep seeing Pascal's face of disgust. All I can see is him complaining about eating ass past 6 o'clock gives him acid reflux. Can't eat no ass after 6 o'clock. It's bad for me. Someone says Jason had demonetized the session. Well, YouTube took down a whole show. The whole show we did with Gene Bajelon's brother got taken down.
Are you serious?
Has a heart attack. Paul what? Prescott said eating ass is resistance. I think Lennon or someone said that.
Oh, he looks so innocent.
Yeah, they took the whole show down because I played 4 minutes of kayfabe. We had a director's little intro cut of how the movie starts, and they said no good. And they said it, what, almost a month later? So definitely Sune, thank you. Arun couldn't get the show canceled, so Jason stepped in. Leave a like on the way out. On that note, we'll be back Tuesday to discuss.
Huh? We'll be back Sunday.
Oh, we'll be back tomorrow morning.
Morning.
Yes, tomorrow morning. Busy. We'll be busy, busy beavers tomorrow morning. And we are. Wait a minute. Wait for it. What are we?
Out.
Out.